Ellie was told she made a career-ending move not once, but two times. But it did turn out to be true. In this episode, we get to hear from Ellie Theachari, who has recently become a tax partner at age 29, and she's been shortlisted two times for Tolly's Taxations Rising Star Award. We dive into key career decisions she's made, challenges she's faced, and what her approach has been to work, all to help you with your own career and progression. You're listening to episode 88 of the Tax Professionals Podcast, the podcast to help you, another tax professional, to progress, develop, and improve your careers. And this is episode 12 of the Tax Career Success Secrets series, sharing the secrets behind the success of high-achieving tax professionals.
Welcome to the Tax Professionals Podcast, the podcast dedicated to helping you improve your tax career. Here's your host, Jack Bonehill.
Hi everyone, and welcome to this episode. I was on holiday scrolling through my LinkedIn about 2 months back, and I saw that Ellie had become a tax partner at Blick Rothenberg. I knew we must have been similar in age, as we were both shortlisted for Taxations Rising Star Award this year, and I was so chuffed for her when I saw that she'd become a tax partner. I always like seeing us youngsters achieving success and defeating the odds despite our age. And it goes to show that age is just a number, and we shouldn't have opportunities taken from us purely based on our age. Whether we do or don't get a particular role should, in my opinion, be based purely on skill, value and merit. And it turns out that Ellie agrees with me. You might be thinking that Ellie took a traditional route to partner, moving up the ranks one by one, but that couldn't be further from the truth. She's taken an unconventional and unique route, it's fair to say, making two of what people told her were career-ending moves. In this episode, Ellie shares with us her unconventional route, why she made the decisions that she did, challenges and lows that she's had, a bit about what a business case is, and her advice to you and others who want to become a tax partner at a young age. Rough timings for each section of this episode can be found in the details section for this episode within your podcast player of choice, or by heading on over to the show notes for this episode at thetaxprofessionalspodcast.com/TTPP88. That's thetaxprofessionalspodcast.com/TTPP88. The link to the show notes that I've just mentioned there is the only link that you need to remember, as all of the links mentioned throughout this episode are included in the show notes. Being able to find the answer to a tax problem or query, regardless of the situation, in my opinion, is a fundamental career skill for any tax professional. But it is also one of those areas that many people find difficult and over-rely on their colleagues for, hindering their progression. And it's not surprising. The right legislation and HMRC guidance can be hard to find, and then once you do find it, you have to analyse it and understand it, which can be time-consuming. Helping you get past these barriers and learning how to do these things is exactly what the Tax Research Masterclass is about. And past attendees have told me how much quicker it's made them at finding the right resource and then getting to the answer, to the extent that these people have become known as the experts in doing this in their team. I'd love for you to let me help you too. And the full details of the masterclass can be found at thetaxprofessionalspodcast.com/masterclasses. And the next one is in February 2024. My next tax advice masterclass is also in February too. Take a look at the masterclasses and use the free business cases that I've created, one for each masterclass, so that your employer will agree to cover the costs and allow you to attend in work time. That's the intention behind it anyway, and obviously there's got to be some case where it doesn't work, but why not give it a go? The previous episode of the podcast was on the 12 areas that make becoming a tax partner easy with Heather Townsend, and she's an expert in this area. So if you are interested in becoming a tax partner, I can highly suggest a listen to that episode. Link to that episode is in the show notes. Without further ado, let's get to the episode. Can you just give us a bit of an overview of your career to date and kind of how you've got to where you are today?
So I've taken a bit of a different route. I know it's not necessarily completely unique, but I started actually going down quite a traditional route. So I was at university and I thought, I don't really know what I'm going to do. I ended up applying to sort of big four top 10 accounting firms to get on their graduate schemes. And during that time, a role came up in Bristol to do direct taxes. I didn't actually know the difference between direct and indirect. So I think, like most people, I ended up kind of falling into the direct taxes route. And within that was corporate tax. So that was kind of corporate tax compliance, advisory, everything that kind of comes with that. And then a couple of years later, there were been some colleagues I'd worked with at my first role, and they said, oh, you should come to this. They'd gone to this R&D tax boutique. They said, oh, I think you'd love it. You should probably give it a go. And I thought, why not? I think I was about 23. I thought, oh, yeah, go on then. Why not? So I went there for a couple of years And that was, yeah, that was fantastic. And that's kind of where I learned everything really at the beginning about R&D. And I was surrounded by absolutely amazing people. Both of those jobs were in Bristol. And then I was relocating back to London. A colleague that I had also worked with in that R&D tax boutique had also relocated to London and had gone into the Big Four. So an opportunity came up there to join their R&D tax team. So I asked her, should I do it? And she said, oh yeah, it's a great place to work. So I went and worked there for another couple of years. So each place has been a good few years. And then during that time, that was the latter part of that was during COVID. And it was quite a difficult transition, I felt, going from being sort of in the office quite a lot of the time to being at home all the time. And then sort of really out of the blue, a recruiter got in touch with me and said, oh, there's this business, an R&D tax business that has just started. It's just really just been incorporated and they're looking for somebody who wants to potentially lead the R&D tax function because they don't necessarily have the tax expertise at the moment. So I thought, why not? It was one of those things where when I'd been at the R&D tax boutique, there were some very young female leaders there. And I'd always looked at that and thought that would just be so cool to do that. And then when this opportunity came along, I thought, oh, is that kind of serendipity in a way? So I thought, yeah, I'll go and do that. So the last 3 years, pretty much up until sort of the September of this year, I was kind of involved in growing that business, the technical side, the tax side, all the other bits and bobs that come with being a company director that you kind of have to do outside of your day-to-day. And then again, an opportunity kind of presented itself to join Dick Rothenberg as a partner, which for me was sort of too good to turn down because it's not an opportunity that comes along every day. And I just saw a huge opportunity here where their R&D tax function was quite small and it needed building and it needed structure and processes. And that's what I really enjoy doing. So I think it all kind of worked out well for me. So that is the long and short of it.
Yeah, and you're obviously being very modest as well, because how old are you right now? You 29, same as me?
I am 29, yes.
Yes. And how many people do you know who's 29 and become a tax partner?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, you're the only one. You're the only one I know.
Yeah, just this little old me. Yeah, I think, but that, to be fair, that is one thing that kind of, that I really liked, because in between the last role and this role, I had a bit of time out. So I spent the summer doing all the fun stuff, getting married, going on my honeymoon, just relaxing a little bit. And I had time to really take these interviews. I could take them very seriously and input quite a lot of time into them. And it's not that every place that I was interviewing did this by any means, but certainly Dick Rothenberg, there was no mention of my age, no mention of, oh, well, you've only been doing this for X amount of years and you should have been doing it for this many years and therefore we can only offer you this position. It was all based on merit and what they were seeing right in front of them, which I really liked, because there were some businesses that said, oh, well, you haven't done this specific role as, say, a director for 4 years or however many years, and therefore we wouldn't be able to do that because of the team structure and all this kind of thing. So yeah, obviously I am proud of myself that I'm a partner at this age. But one of the things that kind of drew me here was that there wasn't kind of any mention of that.
Yeah. And it's a massive frustration to me as well. I hate like the way that some people are thinking you need to do this for X amount of years before you can get there, because it's not really based on skill, is it really, or value? It's based on the amount of time in a role. And we both know, someone can spend 10 years in a role and be no better than what they were 10 years ago, whereas some people will be way better after 6 months or 12 months, for example, because they're just the type of person that likes to learn and get better.
Absolutely. And I think when you're kind of looking through a business, you often, especially the extremely large businesses, you see that all the time. And then those people will invariably leave because they're sort of trapped in a level because they don't have the required tenure or whatever the metric internally is. And I know every business will be, probably anyone who's listening to this who is kind of a business owner would be looking at that thinking, oh, we don't do that. But it's super, super important to make sure that people are being valued based on what they're bringing to the table, not really anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I suppose, because if you don't do that, you just end up losing the people who are really good.
You lose the great people. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so obviously for some people are not bothered about like fast progression and stuff, and they might be happy to sit there for 5 years before the next role comes, and that suits some people fine. But obviously, really, I think the people who do want to progress quickly and stuff probably will come with more value in the short term, and so losing them is like a big dent in, like, I suppose, the team or the firm, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, well, what you've done, you've sort of, you have a skills drain there, don't you? Because you've taken somebody or even perhaps a group of people that were really eager to learn, eager to try new things, and then they'll go somewhere else and they'll take that skill set and be able to add value to that company. Now, obviously, that's not to say people that have no interest in progressing doesn't mean they aren't learning and they're not doing all of these amazing things. Those kind of people probably do just sit better within a more traditional setup, which I think why I have always really quite liked sort of startup or entrepreneurial environments. I think they suit me better, but it's not for everyone.
Yeah. I mean, before you moved to the startup, basically your last role then, mm-hmm. did you know you liked that type of environment though, or do you only know it now because you've experienced it?
I think, as with everything, there's always pros and cons. So prior to that role, I was in the Big Four, and there's the pros and cons of being in the Big Four. It has this, it's this huge machine that works really well and tons and tons of people you can rely on and resources, and you just have access to so many amazing things. On the other side, it's not a particularly entrepreneurial environment, I don't think, for me. I can't speak for anybody else or for any other teams. For me, I didn't feel as though you could affect change possibly as quickly as being either in a smaller company. Obviously, with startup, I mean, you're talking about chalk and cheese there. But I think being in that environment, I realized then that I wanted to be in a more entrepreneurial environment, which is why when that other opportunity came along, I thought this is absolutely ideal. And obviously, you're going from literally one end of the scale all the way to the other, whereas I think where I am now is sort of a good in between. Yeah. You have sort of the great people, great resources, great culture, all of that kind of stuff. And you don't have, but you don't have too much structure. It's not too rigid or formulaic. You can actually come in and say, I have this idea. What do we think about it?
Yeah, that makes sense. So obviously, moving from Big Four to a startup is a it's a pretty bold move, really, isn't it? In the grand scheme of things, like,
what? My husband was literally like, "What are you doing?" I just thought, well, I don't really know. I don't know if during COVID being locked inside all day, I just thought I want to be, I want to try something brand new. I don't know if perhaps, I hadn't had all of that reflection time. Maybe, I don't know if I would have done it, to be honest. But yeah, it was a bold move, but a good move.
Yeah. I mean, like, what was actually going through your mind at the time then, like when you were considering doing it and then when you ultimately decided to actually do it?
I think as with everyone, when they're kind of looking at their life, I was thinking, financially, can we make this work? If I'm going into something which is brand new and it currently has no tried and tested outcome, is this going to be something that, do I kind of back myself enough that I'll be able to make this work and make this into a career and make this into a viable business that can support me and support my ambitions and goals? And I was thinking, I was looking at the market as well, because the R&D market is pretty rough at the moment. It's rougher now than it was 3 years ago, but I was looking at that and thinking, is this the position that I want to be in now? So I kind of looked at those factors and thought, are those things possible? And then on the other side, I thought to myself, why not? I was very conscious that this kind of opportunity might never come around again. Or if it comes around again, it will be too late, or I'll be in some other kind of business or a different kind of position where I probably wouldn't want to do it. So then I just thought, throw a bit of caution to the wind and thought, let's do it.
Yeah. Which obviously in hindsight, even more so at the start of COVID when everything was even more like unsure.
Yeah.
Really, like, I mean, you look back and think, God, that was madness. Like, even though it ended up working out all right, like, obviously you didn't really know that was going to happen, did you?
Jack, the last 3 years have been absolutely fabulous. Good madness, but madness nonetheless. It's just when I look back, and I think probably having some time off over the summer again gave me real, because you don't, there aren't actually often that many periods that you get to really sit back and think, oh, that was pretty cool. That was an interesting time of my life. When it, just the whole ride, the whole journey of being in a startup, you really are learning new stuff almost all the time. And challenges come your way that you've not seen before. I had never been in a position where I had those kinds of different responsibilities. So everything was brand new for me. I didn't always get it right. But you look back and you just think, yeah, it was a crazy time, but it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. What would you say then some of the biggest learnings you got from being in that startup environment that you probably learned much quicker than what you would have done not being in that environment?
I think a lot of the things that I learned were around looking at a business holistically, because actually when you're an employee of a larger business, even if that's 50 people or 20,000 people, you are predominantly looking at what's in front of you. So you'll be doing your role, whatever that is. And on top of that, you may have some people responsibilities, or you might be involved in kind of wider initiatives around where you're working. Broadly, you're just looking at, how do I complete this work to a really high standard? How do I look after fees, all that kind of thing? But I had to then think, okay, well, what is our cash flow? What's our projected leads on and the time frames? When do we need to hire? What processes do we need for when we're hiring? What kind of HR stuff do we need? Contracts, everything. You have to look at the whole business and just say, how is this all working as a function? Which obviously is great now, because I can come into another business, and although I don't have some of the added responsibilities that I had just mentioned, you are just making a little business. That's kind of what you're doing. And when you're starting out, it is very difficult to make those decisions, because you're basing it, or a lot of the time you're basing it on just projection, and projections aren't always correct. And what I mentioned earlier, sometimes we didn't get it right. It's if we overhired, or we'd overpromised something, or in kind of those earlier days. But definitely those were, when you just learn about, I had never really been involved in the preparation of management accounts and all these kinds of things, and monthly forecasting, all that, and then how to actually use that to the best of your ability to make sure that a business can run month to month and pay its bills and turn a profit and all this kind of thing. So a lot of it was actually around, I guess, business management more than anything. Yeah.
Yeah, so like your wider business skills, not tax stuff per se. It's literally about the skills required to run a business successfully, I suppose. And I bet that's also giving you like a better appreciation for like clients as well at the same time, which you wouldn't have maybe had if you hadn't gone through that experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you can speak to them and know the kind of difficulties that they're facing. Because I think previously I definitely didn't have as much of an appreciation. So say you had been speaking to a client, or you'd been asking them for something or whatever, and they were taking a while to get back, or maybe, especially when I was working much more on the smaller end of the market, so the kind of the SME market, you would hear people talking about, oh, we're having cash flow issues, we're having labor issues, we're having XYZ issues. And before, you'd think, oh, right, I'm not entirely sure what that has to do with me. But actually, when you have been in a business, it has everything to do with you. And that's a big deal for those people. So just, it does help you kind of relate to people on a bit more of a, on that level, rather than it just being sort of a transactional business sort of relationship that you've got.
When you did make the move though, anyway, didn't you have some people basically saying like that you're making a mistake, and that you're ruining your career by making this choice? Like, could you just tell us a bit about that, like how it affected you and impacted your decision?
It was difficult, because I think there were a few people that had said those words to me, and there were people I really liked and had a lot of respect for. And it didn't make me lose respect for them in any way. It felt like I knew that I was making this huge decision. I was fully aware of that. And that holds its own gravity, and you hold that on your shoulders anyway. So then to have somebody else coming in and saying, somebody that has really no impact on your life at all, saying, oh, goodbye to your career. I was a bit like, oh, no. Please don't say that. Or just, I don't know, I've never been someone who wants to make other people feel like they're not capable of doing something. So to me, it was really bizarre having people say to me, oh, why would you do that? That's that's never going to work. What's the point in doing that? I just think, oh, well, actually, I don't feel that way. So I would hope that you would actually just be happy for me and then supportive, because it actually doesn't impact anybody else in any way at all.
Yeah. And I think probably part of it comes from a lot of people have fear of like what is not normal. And for people, it's normal, particularly in tax anyway. It's to work for an accounting firm and work your way up. If you want to go all the way to partner and you've got that type of want out of your career, then you do that and then you sit there and then you're there for 10, 15 years, then you retire. And anything outside of that for a lot of people, I think, is abnormal. And I suppose your situation was like on the extreme end of abnormal as well, which made people feel even more like uneasy about it for you. And they probably thought in a way that they were helping you by saying that to like kick you into like reality or something. But
I know, as you say, you'd
already made your decision and you were going to do it. And at that point, it was pointless them saying that, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, it definitely wasn't. It's kind of what I said earlier. It didn't make me think any less of them. I was just a bit like, oh, I don't really know what you want me to do with those comments now. Thank you.
Did it almost change your decision though, or was it not going to change your decision anyway, even though obviously it was quite jarring, I suppose, some of the comments?
No, it was never going to change my decision at all, because I sort of, like I said, I'd always thought that I would like to do that. So when it had come along, I wouldn't say I'm a massively spiritual person or anything like that, but I do, when I look back, even good and bad times, you do sort of end up looking back and thinking, that happened for a reason. And it felt like this opportunity had come to me for a very specific reason. So I was happy to sort of go with that and see where it led. So I wasn't really going to change my mind after that at all.
Yeah. Is it you having a strong mind or being potentially stubborn to some degree?
I don't know. You'll have to ask people that know me a bit better. When it came to that, I don't think it was stubbornness. I was really excited about that opportunity. I certainly wasn't doing it to prove anyone wrong or to say to the naysayers, oh, look what I've managed to do. It was very much for myself. So I think in this example, it was probably just being strong-minded and be stubborn, for sure. I can definitely be stubborn.
And did you do it, you think, thinking about the future, thinking actually this could help me long-term, or were you just doing it because you wanted to experience it? What was your expectation when you were going into it?
So going into it, for me, I definitely saw it as a longer-term stepping stone, because the reality is that business is never going to be multi-million pound international, this, that, and the other. It's never going to be, and it's not trying to be either. It is what it is, which is a great, profitable business. That's what it is. And I thought to myself, if I can make a success of a smaller business and it works out and I understand what it means to run a business and how to do other things like sales and forecasting, all this kind of stuff that I've mentioned before, that will mean that if I then am thinking to myself, I'd like to go back into a bigger practice or even in-house or whatever opportunity comes along, I'll be much better equipped with a whole different range of skills that I wouldn't have got had I not started that.
Yeah. So very much you think you went in it wanting a learning experience from it as well.
Yes. Oh yeah, 100%. I knew that it was going to be challenging and I knew that there would be lots to learn and lots of different things to try. So I definitely didn't think I was going to walk in there and it was going to be a breeze.
No. So then obviously you come to like the end of that when you decided like to leave. Did you know what you wanted at that point and what you're actually looking for? Or was it just that you felt like you now needed a change?
I think by that point, I had sort of come to the conclusion that, because for any small business owner, someone who's running a small business, they will all relate that running a small business is really hard. It takes up a huge amount of your time. You can't, towards the end, it was slightly different because the business is, well, hopefully still is, but definitely was in a very, very good rhythm. But certainly earlier on, you can't really work a 9-to-5. Not really. You have to constantly be thinking about lots of things. And I felt like what I really wanted was to be able to focus on what I really enjoy doing which is meeting and connecting with people and doing my actual job, doing R&D tax relief. That's what I like to do. And I felt like I was being taken away from being able to do that on a day-to-day basis because my time was being taken up with so many other things. So I knew that whatever the next step was, I needed a role that I could focus on those two core things, which is why I knew that I would end up in a bigger business because there are, well, bigger businesses just have those functions that are discrete from the separate teams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just like in reality though, no, because obviously in a partner role, you have certain like expectations in terms of bringing in work and developing a team and growing it and all that. Because if you were saying that like you knew you wanted to do more like R&D to actually work, has that really panned out in practice? Because obviously you've only got limited time, right? And would you not be expected to say delegate that instead rather than do it yourself?
Oh yeah, so I don't mean necessarily be kind of in the weeds doing it myself, but certainly just having more input in as much as interacting with those clients, understanding what they're doing, interacting with the team, doing more training type activities, just having more of a handle on the claims themselves and knowing what's going on in my portfolio and also being somebody that other people can come to and ask questions about R&D, keeping my technical knowledge exactly where it needs to be. So yeah, certainly I wouldn't be, sometimes if I have to actually do the work, that's absolutely fine. I don't mind doing that. But certainly it's more about being able to focus on the core technical aspects of the role rather than everything that's around the periphery.
Yeah, like the forecasting, like the hiring of people and all those other things.
Yeah, because the thing is, now I'm in a position where, for example, if I said, okay, I need another person, we have a talent acquisition team here. So it's not me saying, I need to hire somebody, I need to put an advert out there, I need to do all the interviews, all the contracts, all of the take on, all this kind of stuff. It's I can do all the good stuff, have a team around me to support me.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Oops.
So I'm not even sure if this is a related note, but it's just occurred to me that, because obviously you've been shortlisted twice, haven't you, for the Rising Star Awards for
yes,
for
and for anyone listening, Jack Bonehill, my arch nemesis, won last year, and I have not yet forgiven him.
And I was just thinking, really, like when, because obviously you have to apply for that, don't you? Essentially, put yourself forward.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
Did you? What was the reason that you did that for yourself? Did you think it would benefit your career? Were you doing it to try and win more work at the time when you were still with your last firm? Like, what was the incentive behind doing it for you?
I think, if I'm being perfectly honest, it was a bit of an ego trip. If I'm being totally honest, it was more just you. And it's exactly as I said before, you don't often get times to reflect. So when I was pulling it together, I was thinking, oh, I should have done loads of cool stuff that I want somebody to see and to be recognized for the stuff that I'm doing. And absolutely on top of that, though, it does, although both of us have our qualifications and all that kind of thing, it does help in a way to be able to, when somebody Googles our names, they will see stuff like that. Or if they go on our LinkedIn, it's there. It just adds a few stars around the edges. But yeah, I think it's nice to be recognized for doing things that you are actually doing every day that sometimes don't always seem like that much because it's just part of your everyday. But actually, when you look at it as a whole and you're looking from the February to February, the amount that goes on in a year is huge. And it's just nice to look back, really.
Yeah, you are absolutely right about that. Like, I didn't even think about that at the time when I was doing the application, like the reflecting side of it. I always saw it as a chore in a way because I was doing it to get more exposure for the podcast ultimately.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, try and get it in front of more people. But you're right, like, because you have to essentially reflect on a full year's period and think about the best things that you've done in that period. And then obviously write it in a way that makes it sound even better than probably what it actually was.
Yeah, a little bit of a few sprinkles in there.
Yeah,
fluff it up around the edge.
Yeah, but I think it is good for credibility anyway. And obviously for you, however you've got to become a partner at 29 and do all that you've done, it certainly must have helped some way.
Well, I hope so. I'll have to ask because the partners here, see what they thought.
Just a reminder, if you want to solve any tax problem and be able to use HMRC guidance and tax legislation effectively, then the Tax Research Masterclass could be exactly what you need. Head on over to thetaxprofessionalspodcast.com/masterclasses for full details. That's thetaxprofessionalspodcast.com tax.com/masterclasses. Take a look at the details and use the free business case I've created so that your employer is more likely to agree to cover the costs and to allow you to attend in work time.
Yeah. And you're obviously, I think, overall quite modest. So this question you might find hard to answer, but like, what do you think your secret is personally for like achieving what you have done whilst being, I suppose, beneath 30?
I think there's two things. I think there is no substitute for hard work. There just isn't. You might speak to people who say, oh, I'm not good at this. I'm not good at that. I don't even work that hard. You think, well, you have. You must have done, because you just cannot substitute that. You need to work hard. And working hard doesn't mean working yourself to the bone, burnout, but it just means giving all of your effort to do something and not half-assing things. I think that's one thing. But secondly, just generally, just be nice to people, make good connections. I'm still friends with some of the people that I trained with, people that I've gone through my career with. I've got a whole network of people that I can call if I have a really tricky technical issue. Just build up that network. And it's one of those things, it's kind of build it and they'll come. That is kind of how that works. And getting your name out there a little bit. Also, a third one, actually, I just thought of. Don't pretend to know more than you do. I find it incredibly frustrating when I meet people who just will not accept that they don't know everything. I do not profess to be some R&D tax technical oracle at all. And I don't profess to be the best R&D tax advisor in the world. I know what my skills are. I know what I know. I know what I don't know. And I'm not too proud to ask for help, even in the time that I've been here, who you can lean on and who you can get the support from. So you should do that, and you should use that wherever you can, because the worst thing you can do, really, especially as a partner, if you're trying to win work and you sort of profess to know more than you do, that's going to be found out quite quickly. So it's good to just be comfortable in what you're really good at. Don't try and swim upstream. Just focus on what you're good at. Lean on people. And that can be obviously the people within your network where you can. And just work really hard.
And what would you say then for you are your like strongest skills then that have like helped carry you along?
I think I don't, this is going to sound extremely egotistical, but it's really not meant to. So I don't find it difficult to get on with people or to find common interests or to relate to people. So often when I'm speaking to clients or new prospects or even my colleagues, I don't find it difficult to get on with people. And I have quite a good memory. I can remember very strange facts about someone. So I'll remember that it was our client's Aunt Mabel's birthday last week. So when I speak to them again, bring that up, that kind of thing. So I think making connections, I think I'm quite good at doing that. And then beyond the technical, because although I said I'm not the most technical, I'm not technical. So yeah. I do know some things. I think for me, it's about, I'm quite a process and data driven person. That's not to say that that's kind of a rigid way of doing things, but I'm always open to change. If that fits within making something say more efficient or giving a client a better service or making something easier for the team. So I think just being open to collaboration and making things as simple within the framework of giving a good service and making the team happy as you possibly can.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I found, like, we've only spoken, this is the second time we've actually spoken, isn't it? So it's only the second time. And the first time I probably opened up more to you than I probably should about some things, and that's probably a testament to how you almost like create a safe space for people, for them to share with you and to build those relationships. So yeah, even though we've only spoke twice, I can 100% agree.
Oh no, thank you.
But the other thing you said is almost about like putting in 100% effort all the time, and for me personally, I think that's been a big one, because I never do like a half percent job of anything. Like if I'm doing something, I am doing it to like as close to perfection as what is possible, I suppose, in the time that I have. And I think that's always set me up quite well as well, because then whenever I've like done something, whatever grade I've been at, if it's something new or something I've done before, or if it's for a new client or for an old client, like they, whoever it is I'm working with feels like I've put in a lot of effort. I think that's all you can really ask for people, I would say. And it really does frustrate me when I feel like people aren't putting in that effort. So I'm like, why bother? You know what I mean? Like, just
absolutely.
And if you're gonna spend that time anyway at work, then why not spend it in a way that's creating a good piece of work rather than scrolling through your phone every 5 minutes or something instead? Do you know what I mean? It's just a mindset thing.
Yeah, and I think it is, because also naturally, I'm speaking from my experience, and probably if someone who's listening to this who has managed people before will probably resonate with this as well. If you have a pool of people that you can utilize to help you with work, you are going to consistently choose the person that puts the effort in. Somebody that constantly gives you something that is not that well done or needs a ton of changes, or it doesn't really feel like they've bothered, you're not going to actively choose to work with them. And it's not because you dislike them. It's just you think, well, I want a good job done. So you end up going towards those people with a better work ethic. Or I do anyway. I only speak for myself.
Well, the thing is, why would you choose to make your life more difficult for no reason?
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? That's literally it, isn't it? Because if you can go to person Y or Z, and Z is going to do an excellent job and you're going to have to do hardly anything to change it when it's come back, or you can go to the other person and you've got to spend 2 hours changing it, why would you choose that other person in reality? Like, it might sound somewhat selfish and blunt, but why would you make your life more difficult for yourself?
No, nobody wants that. And also, you don't want to be necessarily encouraging those kind of behaviours either. It's better for everyone. Because in terms of, I don't really like to use the word hierarchy per se, but you know what I mean, in terms of the line of delegation. If the better everybody else is, the better it is for the whole team.
Because
everyone's life is made easier. So yeah, like you said, there's no value in making anyone's life harder throughout the chain of review.
No. And to be honest, actually, from my own experience, there seems to be this mindset, particularly for some like people who are new into tax, say graduate level or junior in some way, where they're like, oh, it's all right, I'm a trainee, I can't be expected to do that. And I think that attitude is just going to set you up for like a slow progression in your career, like straight away. Because why not take, even if you do think it's difficult or something above what's expected of a trainee, why not try? Because then you will learn a lot from it and you will progress and develop much quicker than what you would do otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we sort of in the corporate tax team, there's a grad who's just joined us. He's always asking brilliant questions, always curious about things, always wanting to try new things. And no one expects that they will get it right every time, or that they'll even get it right once. But they're giving it a go, and that's all you can really ask of someone.
Yeah, enthusiasm and effort go a long way, I think, particularly more so
absolutely.
At the start of your career.
I know, just always put your hand up and see what's out there.
Yeah, and you can do that until life wears you down.
Absolutely, I'm not putting my hand up anymore.
But for people like on the outside looking in, like your career and you, like I think it's pretty much everyone, well, as long as they are not thinking jealously anyway, it's clear that you've been successful to date, right? Like to go through the different roles that you have, to be shortlisted numerous times for the taxation awards, to become a partner 29, all like great achievements. And so that perception, I think, though, can probably be like unhelpful for people, because like we live in a world where everyone compares themselves to each other, right? Like even I do it sometimes, and I know it's a bad idea.
Oh, I do. I used to be absolutely awful for that. Absolutely awful for that, yeah.
And it's a social media thing, like, isn't it? I think that's probably why we do it somewhat. But like, I'm not like that very often. And when I do see someone, particularly someone that's young, doing great, like, I think it's great, because I'm always rooting for us, like, young folk to kind of prove that you don't have to be old or exactly, you know what I mean? But even saying that, I still did feel a little bit jealous when I saw that you'd become partner. Like, I just, for some reason, couldn't help it, even though I knew it was irrational. But
well, Jack,
still...
how do you think I felt when your name popped up on that screen at Tolly's? I thought, I've got to get myself out of here. I'm going to cry.
True.
Well, no,
that's
I was, to be honest, obviously, I was super, super happy to see you. And also, it was my second rejection, so I'd been already worn down the previous years.
You guys show, doesn't it? Because obviously, we've almost chosen different routes to each other in a way, haven't we? Because
yeah,
I work
absolutely.
4 days a week, you work 5 days a week. So you can't really compare us either, in a way. The only thing that's comparable is our age, I suppose.
We basically have totally different, we work in different areas of tax, and it's just not comparable. But no, I totally understand. I think jealousy is a natural feeling. And I think probably, I don't want to speak for you, but I think it's not necessarily even a jealousy. I think it's more of a, oh, wish that was me. As
yeah,
in,
yeah.
I can do, oh, yeah, I can do that. Come on, that could be me sort of thing. It's not, oh, I'm not happy for that person. It's, oh, wish that was me.
Yeah, I think you're right. It probably is more of that. Because like,
yeah,
you know, if I'm being completely blunt, these were the thoughts that were going through my head right at the time. It was like, we were both shortlisted, same age, same amount of experience. And so we must be very similar in like skill level. Do you know what I mean? Or value
yeah.
in some way. And
yeah,
so
then absolutely,
I was thinking, well,
yeah.
if Ellie's got it, then have I not got it? Is there something I've done wrong? Do you know what I mean? And then you start questioning yourself. And even though I know in reality that I haven't and I've done what's right for me throughout my career so far.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But like
yeah.
having that set in mind anyway, though, I think it's useful to acknowledge that we don't always have things that are playing sailing. And I know for you in particular, you've had some like challenges yourself. Mm. So could you share with us a bit about those and what they are and I suppose how you've addressed them and overcome them?
When I was doing my, one that instantly springs to mind is my CTA exams. I just found those so difficult. I don't think there are many people that absolutely sail through them, but I just honestly found them so hard and I failed a couple of times. And each time you just sit there and you think, oh, I don't know if I can realistically pull myself back to have to do that again, especially I think with the CTA exams as well, because you don't necessarily get the feedback. You don't necessarily always know what you've done wrong. And each time I failed, it was really, really close. It was in about 2 marks. And part of me felt like, oh, I wish I'd got T or something. Cause then you'd know that you simply didn't understand what you were looking at. But I found that super hard. And I definitely, also at the time where I was working, there were lots of us going through it at the same time. And I was one of the only ones that failed. So I just felt like, oh no, everyone's judging me. Obviously they weren't, but you know, that's kind of how you feel when you go through that. So I definitely think that I just built some resilience to pick up my books again and start again and get on with that. And anyone that has passed those exams knows the absolute euphoria when you get that email through. And it's like, you've passed, you don't have to do anything else. Just pay us and you can keep it forever. And it's like, yes, okay, sure, I'll do that. And I think another difficult time really is, it does kind of touch on what we had said before. There have been, I'm not saying that there is nothing wrong with staying in one firm for a long time or staying there for your whole career or whatever. I've chosen not to do that. And just because some opportunities have come along the way. And I definitely have felt like people that I have worked with or that I know haven't always necessarily been happy for me. And I think it's in those moments where I've really doubted myself, because although I don't in myself tend to think that I need external validation, I must do, because in those moments, like to a degree, because in those moments, I thought to myself, oh gosh, am I doing the right thing? Am I making a huge mistake? Even from the very beginnings when I left my first job to go into my second, again, I was told, it was someone actually said to me, you don't ever see R&D tax partners. And I definitely don't sit here now and think middle finger up, like, look at me now. I don't feel like that. But so at the time when I was 22 years old, having a partner saying that to me, it was really damaging to my confidence. And I was so sad about that. And it did sort of color the first few months with the next role, because I thought, oh my gosh, I need to make this work, because I have people telling me that it will never work. And I think in terms of how I overcame that, I think it really was just time. And you just grow up, don't you? The difference in who I was 8 years ago to now, I hope is not the same person. It might be, but yeah, it's all just time. And just realizing that, without sounding extremely cliche, everybody is on their own journey. Everyone is doing their own thing, and it has absolutely no impact on me whatsoever, and vice versa. Whatever I'm doing is not relevant to anybody on the outside looking in terms of an actual impact on their life. So if somebody were to say, I had unfortunately heard from an extremely good friend of mine that she'd been to some kind of alumni event and someone had said, oh, I don't know how she's managed that. She must have lied on her CV, all of this about me becoming partner. I just thought, whatever. You do what you need to do and I'll do what I need to do, because it doesn't really matter anymore. It's not going to change anything for me. I'm I'm still here doing what I want to be doing.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, it just sounds like spitefulness, doesn't it, more than anything, when people make comments like that? Because why not just be happy for them? Like, oh, fair play. They managed to achieve that after the squiggly route that Ellie's gone through.
Absolutely. You know what I mean? My good old squiggly route. Yeah. It's the best one.
Yeah, but I think you're only normal anyway with feeling like you need some level of validation in those situations.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because when it's such an extreme comment as well, like, it's not the thinking, oh, like, are you sure, Ellie? Might not be the right move. They're literally telling you it's the worst thing you could do to your career. Like,
oh,
it's
of course,
not
shit. And at the start of my career as well, I was thinking, oh, fantastic. I'm 2 years in and it's over.
Yeah, exactly.
Really, come to an end.
Yeah, so as you say, really, in those cases, just time, maturity, and you now realise that it doesn't matter what those other people think. Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, I think, so I guess sort of my advice to anyone really that wants to take a different route in their career, just like, if you do work hard and you're doing all the things that you want to be doing, it will all work out in the end, even if it doesn't always feel like it at the time. It will always figure itself out.
I suppose worst case scenario, just looking back at yours in particular, when you went into when you first started specialising in R&D, if it didn't work, you've wasted you've used 2 years of your life and then you can go back. So you would have still been able to get to the same point just maybe 2 years later. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not
absolutely
the end of the world, is it?
No. And I certainly, when the startup opportunity came along, when I was speaking to my family about it, they were very much like, well, you have your qualification, so if this doesn't work, just go to another firm. Even if you have to go cap in hand back to where you were, just do that. And I thought, I do actually have those qualifications. I can do something else with them. It's not when, and sometimes I was actually speaking to a colleague the other day, and we were just saying, well, what would happen if they just got rid of the R&D scheme tomorrow? I thought, well, I will just go back into corporate tax. And if that did mean that I would have to come in at a lower level to sort of retrain, then so be it. You just have to take it as it comes.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's face it, like, even though you focus purely on R&D, you're still getting involved, I imagine, at least sometimes in the wider corporation, or at least getting awareness of it or hearing about things that are happening, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I can certainly talk to a client about corporation tax issues as they are. When it gets very specialist or very technical, that's when I would introduce another member of the team. But it's not like I've forgotten those things, and I do try and keep up with what's going on. And as you said, just from being around people and hearing them talk and all that kind of stuff, it's sort of by osmosis. You just get into your brain.
Yeah, you do. Absolutely. So one of the big things that I suppose happens when you want to become a partner is you have to create a business case, which I always think sounds like a scary thing. People don't really know what it is. You Google online and everyone says, oh, no one can tell you what a business case looks like. It's got to be your own thing. You're like, but surely there must be something that people expect, and you must be, you know what I mean? There's literally nothing out there. But like, what is a business case? And like, can you tell us, I suppose, the story of creating one for your partner role at Blick, like how it happened and went in,
absolutely,
et cetera?
So the business case, really, I mean, I think it is slightly different at Blick Rothenberg just because it's private equity owned. So the partners are employees rather than being, say, equity partners of an LLP. So I can obviously only speak for this specific scenario. So essentially, in order for you to become a partner, when you're looking, and actually, to be honest, this might just translate over to both, you need to kind of justify your cost and justify how you're going to build up that service line. So what I was looking at really was, based on the information that Blick Rothenberg had given me about their types of clients and the number of people, the revenues in certain parts of the business, that kind of thing, I was able to put together a guide of what I thought the next 3 to 5 years could look like. And that involved turnover, what kind of recovery profit that I would make. So often you would, in the first year, you might expect that to be lower just because you're out doing a huge amount of BD. You might not have the resource and you might be having to do a bit more of the actual work yourself just while you're getting set up. So you look at the turnovers, then you'd look into each of the years and say, once I reach X metric, whatever that metric might be, I will need to hire this person. I will need this resource. So that's kind of the numbers part of things. Alongside that, I had also put what kind of ideas I would have for putting process in place. Now, the reason I did that here was because there wasn't an established R&D process or R&D team. So I had a bit more flexibility over saying, I would like to potentially introduce this bit of software or run it like this, that kind of thing, which perhaps might not be so necessary if you're going into an already established team that kind of has those processes in place. But that, to be honest, that was pretty much it. Not to say that it was a very simplistic document, but you're basically just saying, what will my business look like in 3 to 5 years?
Yeah. How much detail do you go into? Because let's just think about like winning work, for example. Mm-hmm. Like obviously there's loads of ways that you can win work. And did you have to say, I'm going to win work by doing X, Y, and Z? Or did you just have to say like, I expect to win this much from the firm's clients? Do you know what I mean? Like what level of detail did you have to go into?
Yeah. So one of them was exactly as you just said. So based on the information that I had been given, I could say, right, I think X amount is going to come from internal, X amount will come from additional referrals from those internal referrals, and X amount will come from marketing and external networking. So kind of a prospect coming in that has nothing to do with Nick Rottenberg already. Luckily, the firm has had quite a lot of partners and they have amazing portfolios. So at the moment, I'm predominantly sort of digging into those. But that's the kind of the thing with a business plan. Because you're not actually in the business and you're going based on the information that you have, there's only a finite size that can be, because you just don't have enough information to be very, very granular. But what I was able to do, just from experience of having been in my old business, I could say the average fee in the R&D tax industry is X. I am anticipating to win X number a year. So then I can calculate, I think roughly I would be able to make this much in turnover for this business line per year. And this will be the cost of it. And therefore, if we're doing this much utilization, this much recovery, that kind of thing, that means that we should make X amount in this business line.
So just to hone down, I'd say one element to that for a second. So you said about like winning work internally. So
yes.
Did you have to say how you were going to win work from the internal clients? Or did you just have to say like, I'm going to do it from building, say, relationships with the other partner? Do you know what I mean? Like how much detail did you have to go into like on each little bit of that?
Yeah. So the internal, again, you've read my mind, Jack. It's like you read my business case. Yeah, it was definitely, yeah, for the internal, it was very much how you would strategically work your way through the partner portfolio. Obviously, they're massive. You can't just attack all at once. So the strategy behind that, and then how you would get referrals from those clients, which is quite a different thing, because ultimately you need to build up a very good relationship with that client on the work that you're doing. Because say an audit partner, they might have a fantastic relationship, but if you do a shoddy piece of work, they're not going to introduce you to anyone that they know. And then the external was slightly more brief, just because it's the usual route to market that you might expect. But that was slightly later on in the business plan, because that wasn't the key focus for years 1 to 3. So that bit was slightly more brief.
Yeah. And I imagine anyway, by the time you actually end up getting there, you might end up changing it anyway, because you might have better ideas or different ideas. The landscape might be different.
Yeah. And your strategy that you might have started with actually doesn't work that well, and you need and you need to tweak it. But that's why, I mean, a business case is pretty flexible. It's more just, if you were to actually take it back to the bare bones, do you have enough? Well, are you going to generate enough work to justify a partnership?
Yeah, and I suppose convincing the other person that what you put in that paper isn't a bunch of nonsense and it's realistic.
Oh, absolutely. If I'd have come in and said months 0 to 6, 100 clients, 10 million revenue, they would have thought, what is this woman talking about? So you have to be realistic. And actually, I think when I went into my business case, obviously then you're interviewed on your business case. One of the partners said to me, I actually think you should lower this ever so slightly. I was like, all right, fair enough. Better than getting it up. But yeah, that's kind of what goes into the business case.
And in your case as well, then, have you come in like having any staff to be put in your team straight away, or did you literally just come in you and you've had to then go and get people from like day one?
Yeah, so there's a manager who has been working in R&D for a couple of years now, who really wanted to get involved in R&D and was super, super keen. So he's going to be obviously and continue winning the work, so that can be a full-time role. There's a senior manager who also has worked on R&D in other businesses and here for a long time. So I've got that resource. And then at the moment, we're in the process of utilizing some more junior staff, sort of train them up, but certainly just sort of looking to the future and looking at sort of dedicated resources that is the next step for next year.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, because you've almost had you have had a blank piece of slate somewhat, haven't you? But then in other ways, yes, you've had or you've already had some things in, not the processes and stuff necessarily, but you've already had some stuff in place. So you had something to work with at least.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think just having the two people there already, that they can speak to clients, they do understand the technical side of things, they are able to field questions. And so it's not every single thing is coming via me, has been massively, massively helpful while I'm trying to just bounce around and win work.
In terms of working hours then, because I'm sure some people must look at you and think, oh, she must have worked so many hours to become a partner of her age. It's just not possible to do it without working 6 until 10 o'clock every day or something ridiculous.
What is the
reality for you?
An average day, I do think I just work regular hours. I can be a little bit naughty sometimes when I'm at home because I'm already awake. Sometimes I just think, oh, I'll just log on a bit earlier and then I'll maybe log off a bit later. But it's certainly, I'm not sat there absolutely going through it all day long. I think it's so important to have a healthy work-life balance, because you simply cannot do your job as effectively as you need to if you aren't having the right amount of rest and doing things that you want to do. I don't want to work every hour under the sun. I don't. I enjoy my job. I love what I'm doing. But I also love spending time with my friends, my family, doing my hobbies. I don't want to be working all the time. So yeah, pretty much. I mean, my usual working hours at the minute are 8 till 5-ish. If as we approach Christmas, because for anyone listening that's in R&D, they will know that sort of December, March, September are the really, really busy periods. So yeah, I might have to work a bit later then. But other than that, I certainly don't work really, really long days. But I think, obviously, I've only been here for a very short amount of time, but I think that's very much led by the other partners here as well. There's no pressure to be at your desk all the time or to just, and there's no presenteeism kind of thing. People are very respectful of people's home lives and other responsibilities that they have. So it's very, very flexible.
Yeah, I'm completely on the same page as you with the work-life balance stuff as well. Looking back, usually when I ask this question, I'm speaking to someone that's got 20 years experience and they've been working with 20 years experience. This is different because it's obviously much closer to you when you started. But if you could now give your younger self some career advice, knowing what you know now, what do you think it would be?
Just don't sweat the small stuff. I used to I just used to compare myself a lot to other people and think, oh, what are they doing? How can I do that? All this kind of stuff. But that doesn't necessarily always translate to you then doing those things. It's more focusing on that. Or somebody, I think it was just a lot more sensitive. And maybe that is just an age thing. Maybe that's not something that you can maybe advise the younger self on. But some comments used to really deeply affect me. Or if I got negative feedback, I would think, oh my gosh, I'm terrible at my job. But it's just when I look back on some of those times, I just think, oh no, that was such a waste of effort and a waste of emotion. Everyone makes mistakes. Nobody's perfect. If you're doing a good job, everything's fine.
Yeah. Thing is, feedback's a funny thing anyway, isn't it? Because it depends on your frame of mind at the time, I think, when you receive it sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. If you're having the worst day ever and someone says, just by the way, and I don't know, because what we used to always get was the shit sandwich of this was really good, this was awful, but don't worry about it, it's fine. And I think the bits of the bread would be thrown in the bin. The middle bit I would pour over, absolutely pour over. And it's just so silly. And I think probably a big part of that was because I really wanted to do it right, but I wanted to get it perfect. And we had said earlier, we both put a huge amount of effort into something. If that then didn't translate into a really good piece of work, I would feel so disappointed with myself, when actually I should have really just taken more time to just take that feedback on and not worry about the kind of teeny weeny little details of it. I just needed to look at the feedback, acknowledge it, understand how to not understand the changes that needed to be made, and then actually just implement them.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny, isn't it? Because usually, I am a big fan of feedback. I always have been, because I think it's the quickest way to learn. It's bespoke to you. You're not just getting generic information from online. Someone is telling you what they think you could do better. And so I always think you should listen to it. But probably 2 months ago now, I had some feedback just at a time when I thought that this person was like nitpicking at me for small things. Mm. And it came at like the worst time, when I was convinced that they were trying to do certain things, and I just didn't take it well at all, because I went back straight away. In a way, I probably shouldn't have in hindsight, but I did it anyway. And I know that was a mistake, but I do appreciate now, to be fair, after that experience, that how you're feeling in that moment can affect how you take the feedback. Even if the intention of the feedback is good, you can sometimes think it isn't, can't you?
Well, it's the feedback hangover, isn't it? You there might, exactly as you said, you might think something's happening, and maybe it is. Maybe that person wasn't nitpicking you, perhaps. Then you get the negative feedback. Then you get something else. And it's like you haven't ever recovered from that kind of negative feeling that's kind of running through everything. Whereas if someone that you get on really well with, you love working with, gives you a bit of negative feedback, you're like, right, okay, fair enough. Yeah. But actually, that might be what that other person was trying to do. I mean, every single person that has worked in a professional services firm has had that. And nobody can profess that they haven't gone back and snapped back a little bit of feedback. We've all done it. Everyone should admit that, because it is not, there is no shame.
No. Agreed. So just one last question for you then, Ellie. So there's definitely people out there that are like super keen to just like accelerate their career progression. And I've always been one of those people. It'd have been so nice, I suppose, back when I started, to be able to get that advice from someone that's done it like very recently, like you have. So for those people who do say want to become a partner really quickly, like as quick as possible, like what is your advice to them?
You need to be good at either, because you can get two types of partners, really. I mean, the absolute dream is that somebody is really, really technical, really great at networking and sort of selling something. So I guess if you want to call it sales, you can. But to get that, I would say it's probably pretty rare to get both of those. So either be unbelievably technically, so that you are sort of the go-to, but do value that. So don't let somebody sort of take advantage of how good technically you are. And or be really good at connecting with people. Be a connector. So early on in your career, that means just getting to know people. It's not about having some kind of strategy or some technique. It's just get to know people, get to know different senior managers, directors, partners, and invariably say, can I help you with a piece of work? Can I shadow you? Can I come to a meeting? Those kinds of things, just to get yourself out there, because that gives you the right exposure. And you doing that early on, it's what we were talking about earlier. Those partners will then think, oh, yeah, I remember Jack. Yeah, he came to a meeting with me and he was great. Let's get him again. And then it just sort of builds up your network, and people think you're kind of in people's minds of somebody that they want to work with.
You know what, actually, from this conversation today, I think that you and me are the opposites with our strengths. My strength is definitely the technical side of things.
Yeah, amazing.
That's where I think my strength lies. And it sounds like to me yours lies with the networking and the more sales side of the role.
Yeah, but yeah, absolutely. And you, there is nothing stopping somebody that is very, very technical from becoming a partner at all. You just have to work on your strengths and just make sure people know about that strength, and you're making sure that you're being recognized for that strength. Because in the same way that you might lean on somebody who is, say, very, very good at networking to try and connect you with a client or something, I certainly rely on my colleagues and not even colleagues here, but even peers, people that we work with, consultants, whoever they are, for the really, really deep technical stuff. And that is fine. I'm not ashamed that I'm not the number one R&D tax legislation person in the country. And that's fine.
For people who want to learn more about you then, Ellie, or maybe get in touch, where are the best places for them to go?
So you can go on my LinkedIn. Blake Rothenberg has a page with partners on it. So you can see my picture where I look very orange. Very, very orange. I've just come back from holiday but you know, it stands out from the page. I'll tell you that. So you can definitely find it there. Those are the two main places.
I really enjoyed speaking to Ellie in this episode. I find it refreshing speaking to a fellow youngster, I think, and hearing about the bold decisions that she's made, but also how she's made it work for her. A key takeaway for me from listening to Ellie was definitely that you should do what you want to do, regardless of what other people are saying, if you think it's right for you. And Ellie's done that clearly a few times when she's gone from larger businesses to smaller ones, and particularly when she made the leap to the startup. Show notes for this episode are at thetaxprofessionalspodcast.com/TTPP88. And the show notes include links to my masterclasses, Ellie's LinkedIn, and the previous podcast episode, which is on the 12 areas to become a tax partner. And the guest on that episode was Heather Townsend, who's just an expert in this area. She's dedicated pretty much her whole career to it. Take a look at the free business cases that I've created for the masterclasses, which you can use and hand to your employer to increase the chances and to help convince them to cover the costs and later attending work time. The business cases give a summary of the course and the benefits to both you and your employer. Copies of these are on the masterclass pages. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you don't miss out on any future episodes by heading on over to thetaxprofessionalspodcast.com/subscribe and sign up for email notifications for all future episodes. Episodes are bi-weekly and are released on Mondays. But that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed the episode and have taken away some useful things that can help you to progress, develop, and improve your tax career. Until next time.